I'm Angie, and I'm an alcoholic. I feel like I've already had a convention. It's been a great weekend, and getting to know so many people. I'd like to thank Clem and the committee for inviting me. I'd like to thank Katrina and her husband Lee for picking me up at Sacramento. I started out at the right time, but it just took me 12 hours to get to Sacramento from Blythe. Some of you may think it might take longer. Surely you all know where Blythe is. That's where God sends you when He's punishing you for asking for a specific ship. But, oh gosh, I wasn't going to say any four-letter words. That's going to be my four-letter word for the morning. It's almost not the spiritual meeting anyway. If I wait 5 minutes, it doesn't matter what I say from here. The reason that I'm in Blythe is because some of us will go to any length to be married. And I want you to know that today is my 8th wedding anniversary. That's 25 for normal people. I've never been married this long, and I'm a multi-marrier. I noticed that in my tag it says Angie B, and it's really Angie D. I very seldom give my last name because I am a multi-marrier, and that's subject to change. It's deal like in deal pickles, you know, very appropriate. But the reason that I'm in Blythe with this guy is because he never had it so good. You know, I've got him convinced of that. He thinks I'm wonderful most of the time. And we are both dedicated to making me happy. And that's what makes him wonderful. I have had him convinced that a woman's place is in the mall. However, I had to put my credit cards away because I think credit cards belong to mature people, and I'm not in any much danger of that. I'm really a young person in an old container. The story and the message of Alcoholics Anonymous has already been said here at this convention. And I know that it's the message, not the messenger. And I know that we all come and share with one another and talk in our own particular ways and reach our own particular people that need to know where we come from for the identity of the heart to instead of being said here today. I will not say or anything that is unique here today about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I will tell you how it's been filtered through me and the places I come from. I also have a deep sense of belonging in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I also never belonged anywhere before. I had an emptiness inside of me that was always there, and I didn't know what it was. I just know that I had a hunger, a longing, and a yearning inside of me. But the ruling emotion of most of my life and longing to my sobriety was this emptiness and not knowing how to fill it up. I used to hold myself and rock myself and wail like a wounded animal, and I didn't know how to name that feeling. I just know that it hurt so bad, and that it was with me long before I ever took my first drink. Because I live in Blythe today doesn't mean that I originated there. I'm still visiting there, as I've told you. And I really come from Orange County. I was born in Orange County when they had oranges in Orange County. I was born in a little barrio. For those of you that don't know what a barrio is, in case you're trying to figure out, I'm a Mexican. I know you can't tell that much, but I was born and raised in a little barrio in Orange called El Medina. In the days that I was raised there, we didn't let any Anglos in, and they weren't too anxious to come in there either.
I was of the generation that would join the gangs and beat each other up and call it fun. I guess they still do that someplace, and now it sounds like it's really bad, but at that time it was fun. I heard a lady say once that every time that they had parties, the paramedics would come, and I thought about that, and I thought, you know, every time we had parties, the cops would come. That's the way it was, and I was born into a family that wasn't ready for me then, and it isn't ready for me now. My family is not very impressed with what you've done with me, especially my mother. She would have rather you sobered me up a little more quieter. I think I just got worse after I got sober, because then I didn't care, because my sponsor assures me that even a stop clock is right twice a day, so I figured. I was born at a time when they kept the mothers in the hospital a whole week, and when they came home with his baby, they still didn't have a name for me. And the reason for that is because my daddy wanted to name me after his girlfriend, and my mother's narrow-minded. My mother is of the little purple lip variety, not blue lip, because she's a Mexican. The little purple lips, they get smaller. And my daddy liked to have a good time, and they were divorced when I was 7. And she would say things to me like, "You're just like your father." And I knew what her opinion was of him. She didn't like him too well. I had an older sister that was perfect. You know the type I'm talking about. They always told her what to do, and she always did it right. And she screwed it up for me, because I never knew how to be good. I never remembered how to be good until after I was bad, and then it's too late because they're always whipping on me. And I didn't know I was a better child. I thought that was the price you paid for not knowing how to be good. I have a younger brother, and all he had to do was be there. And, you know, they always gloat at you when you're getting whipped on. So she would send me to the nuns so they could teach me to be a lady. And what the nuns thought was a lady wasn't appealing to me then, and it isn't appealing to me now, because not only did I not know how to be good, but I may not have thought of doing it, but as soon as they said, "Thou shalt not," I had an overwhelming desire to do it. I would get it in my head, and I couldn't get it out until I did it. Then you can relax. I'm not too much different about that today. There's a energy that I get when somebody says, "Don't do something." And so somebody dared me and erased the nun's curtsy, what she wore under all them clothes, and they 86 me from catechism, and I got home and got my whipping. And the next day when I got to school, all the kids thought I was terrific. God, it seems to me, I told you that I was born with an emptiness in my soul, a yearning, a longing, a hunger to be loved, to be wanted, to be accepted. And as a child, I used to worship my mother. I wanted her love and her approval so desperately, because that's what I thought would fix me. And I didn't get it. And so when I got all that attention from them kids at school, it filled up some of them empty places. And I knew how to get a little bit of what I had, I wanted. I'm one that believes that I always had the pilot lit. All I ever needed was the fuel. And what happened is that I ran off to be with my daddy because I knew it was going to be better over there. It had to be better over there. I had gotten into so much trouble at home with my mom, and I ran off to my daddy, who was over in the San Fernando Valley where he'd taken up light housekeeping with a lady with 8 kids, and all he wants is one more. Right here comes trouble. And he used to bring people up north to pick grapes and prunes, and we were fruit pickers. You know, God made 2 kinds of Mexicans. That's fruit pickers and non-fruit pickers. And I'm not a fruit picker. They try to make a fruit picker out of me a damn day. We stayed beyond the season with the Gallo brothers, over in a dreary little, looks like something out of the Twilight Zone town at that time, by the name of Livingston. I don't know if anybody knows where that's at. We lived in the middle of those great vineyards, you know, where you look down the vineyard and there's miles and miles of nothing but them suckers. God, I still like grapes and I like wine there, but I just don't like that work. I don't even like gardening today. It ruined me forever. That's not so bad. But we stayed beyond the season with the Gallo brothers, and they gave my dad a case of sherry wine, and somebody must have said, "Thou shalt not." I had a big water glass of that sucker, and when it went down good. I mean, it went down there, and everything felt good. I don't know about you, but everything felt warm and wonderful. It's just too bad something that good has to be wasted on social drinkers who don't appreciate it. Gotta! I appreciated it. And I wanted more. There's two buttons that I guess God gives us. One of them's enough, and one of them's more. And I had the one that says enough left out to make up for it. I had the one that had more and by the bucketfuls. Then it's the next day, because somehow, I don't know what happened. But it's the next day, and I come to, and you know, the pachucas in my hair, I had them big hairdos, you know, red. And they come back through the next day, and all the hairs out of your face, all stuck to your face. And I was a puking drunk the very first time out. I also don't know what happened. I knew it was something terrible, but I don't know what happened. And it seems to me that I started a lifetime of looking at people's faces, trying to figure out what I had done, terrified to know and terrified not to know. And I started a lifetime of secrets, and it was conscious secrets. I had always had secrets, but this is the beginning of trying to hide whatever I had, that it had bothered me, whatever I had done the night before. And I built walls between me and people, and I lied. And I pretended like I was a clown, and I didn't care or tough or whatever. But there was always that loneliness inside of me that I knew I couldn't tell anybody. And I had a sense of shame of being dirty, so different and so dirty. And that's the way it always was with me. I came back to my mother's, and I wasn't wanted there. I was told that I was incorrigible and they didn't want me home. And I was just a child. I was not quite 13 when I went back to Orange County, and I started living here and there and everywhere, wherever people would put up with me for a little while. And people would always put up with me for a little while because they felt sorry for me. But sooner or later, I would be like the cow that gives the milk and then kicks the bucket over. You know, it just doesn't matter how many points I made in the beginning. It all ended up the same, where people would look away and would not give me eye contact, and I would imagine what they were thinking, and it's time to move on. Well, I'll tell you what happened to me at that time. I loved the parties. You know, we Mexicans like those parties that last for the whole weekend, and you get drunk several times, and you kill somebody or want to kill somebody, or always trying to beat up somebody or love on somebody. And also, I was one of the original topless, bottomless dancers in them parties. And I don't even get paid for it. I don't even remember it. You know that? The girls always want to tell me what I did the next day, so I used to beat them up, and then they didn't tell me. I don't know how not to do that stuff. It never occurred to me not to drink. People would say things to me like, why do you drink the way you do? Why don't you take a little buttermilk or olive oil when you drink? That way it'll coat your stomach, and you, well, all it did was ruin my clothes when I threw up because they never occurred to me not to have something, because that's the only way that I could have fun. I live for thrills, and I live for excitement. That was made me, gave meaning and substance to my life, because I couldn't stand to be without anything, because then I knew I wasn't wanted. Then I knew that people didn't like me, not really. Also, I don't know how to work, because I'm just a child. And so I take up burglary. I have an affinity with Debbie over here. She's the only one that I ever heard from a podium being brassy enough to say that she was a burglar. I wasn't a bad person. It just seemed to be a good idea at the time. And things that belonged to other people were always much more interesting than those things that belonged to me. I didn't have very much anyway, and it's a lot of fun going to other people's drawers, and it's like Christmas when you open Christmas presents. It's just really interesting, and then the added excitement of running away from the cops because it's something thou shalt not do. do. And it really was a surprise to me when the state of California discovered me. They didn't understand that my case was different, that I wasn't a bad person. So they took me up before a judge, and there's my mother. You know, that was always an embarrassment to them people, because them are the people that did a lot of stuff all the time, but they don't want nobody else to know, because other people will be talking about them just like they're talking about the other people. And I'm a walking bus, never got away with nothing. So here I am, my mother and my aunt and all these people with their little purple lips are looking at me. And the judge sits there doing whatever judges do, and he says, "Well, young lady, what do you think we ought to do with you?" Well, I'm cool, right? So I slink down on my chair and say, "Well, you're the judge. You ought to know." That was the wrong person to have that kind of an attitude with. And I learned my lesson just like I do all of them after it happened. But then it's too late. He sent me up to do a little bit of time for the state of California because he didn't understand. And I go over to the Ventura School for Girls. And I like to say that because every so often one of you comes up and whispers, "I was there too." Should I just say it in front of God and everybody? Somebody told me you're afraid people will find out something about you. Tell them and then you won't be afraid. And so I just took that literally. I don't know how to be good there either. I'm a walking bust. Everything I do, I get caught at. And so they want me to do 9 months, and I do 13 months because I don't know how to be good there either. And when they finally let me out, I thought I'd be the only gray-haired little old lady in that girls' reformatory. She says everything I did, I got caught at, and I'd like to do things that are exciting. When they let me out, I took my very first inventory. I'm always one of the ones to live in the answer and not in the problem. As I don't have a job, I don't have any money, I don't have any education, I don't have a home, I don't have anything. So I thought, what an order, I can't go through with it. I better go out and find me a husband, because God knows I need somebody to take care of me. And so I'm of the era that you live, find a man and live happily ever after. So I went out looking for a husband in places that husbands are not to be looked for. And unfortunately for both of us, I found one. He was a dreamer like me. He built them castles in the air and I lived in them. And 3 months later we were pregnant and I was married in that order. And I married a mainline heroin user, and you just don't live happily ever after with one of those. Very exciting, but not very happy. You know, there's a certain type of man that always caught my attention. You know, they got the big muscles, and they wear them little T-shirts, and they got the tattoos. They walk with a little slouch, and the hair's all greasy and black and beautiful, and shiny eyes and big teeth, lots of teeth. And they say, "What's happening, baby? Oh, God, this is so cool." I used to think that look was charisma. Today I know it to be psychosis. I tell you what. I mean, you tame you one of those, you know you got you one. I don't want any of them boring, bland types. Give me somebody like a wild horse to tame. We were quite equipped for being married, this guy and I. He had an idea what a good Mexican wife should be, and I had an idea what a good Mexican husband should be, and never the twain shall meet. And I got the scars to prove it, and he's got the scars to prove it. He starts hearing them stories about me and them bars, and he doesn't like people talking that way about his wife. So he decides I should stay home and learn to be a wife. Well, I'm a good Mexican wife. I want to learn to be subservient, too. My sponsor says you can't make chicken salad out of chicken shit. Well, I'm here to tell you you can try, because I've tried. He don't want me to drink except when he lets me, because he'll get real violent and want to kill him. But he introduces me to little white pills with crosses on them. I don't know what they are, but I sure knew what they did to me. I had one eyeball over there and one over there, and I'd make baby clothes all night long. The same one, over and over, turn them up and get it, trying to get it just right. And you know, you scratch. Oh, God, you love to scratch and chew gum, and the inside of your mouth is raw, and your arms are raw from scratching your rear and everything else. And sing them Mexican songs with them mariachis and get up there big and pregnant and clean your house with a toothbrush and just all night long. And Jesus, you don't care if anybody else is there or not. You're having lots of fun. You know, it is funny, and we do laugh, and I laugh about it today. But do you know what it is to feel all the hopes and all the dreams of a child in a woman's body, trying to make something work that just could not? And yet I wanted so desperately so somebody to love me. All I ever wanted was somebody to love me. I was so hungry for love, I'd have given my heart to anybody that would have taken it. And I just wanted so much, needed so much. By the time I had my baby, I realized this man didn't want to be married. And I knew it was because he was married to me and he had found something that was ugly and disgusting about me, that he didn't want me. So when they put that baby in my arms, I felt like finally, somebody belongs to me. That baby inspired feelings within me that nobody ever has before or since, you see. I knew she belonged to me, and nobody could ever take her away from me. I loved my baby. I promised her I would never mistreat her, abandon her, beat her, and discard her as I had been. And I meant it with every fiber of my being. If I could have been any different for anybody else, it would have been my baby. I just loved her so much. And you know, she still does those things in my heart. She still brings out then protectiveness and love. And that's further on down. And there's a little baby. I took her and her sister to places the children should not be taken. Way down inside of me, there was always a spark of the woman that I am today. But I thought that there was a monster that lived within me. And I took that baby and her sister to places that children should not be taken because I am an alcoholic. After the second one was born, I left their daddy because he sure wasn't changing the way he said he would. And besides, I was getting old. I was 22 years old and I felt ancient. I know it sounds silly, but I feel younger today at 55 than I did then at 22. And I left him and I went out husband hunting again because God knows I could not take care of myself. And I needed somebody to take care of me, and then now we got us. Besides, my mother had said I was probably going to be like a rabbit and have a baby every year. Why did I always remember? I always hugged to me the negative. I always hugged to me the rejection. I never remembered the kindness. I always just remembered the ugliness. And I'm sure that my mother said some other things to me, but I didn't remember them. It seemed that I just gleaned from everything and anybody that which would put me down and cast me aside. I went out and I looked for a husband, and I didn't find one because the ones that wanted me, I didn't want, and the ones that didn't want me were so busy running from me. But I fell in love, and I've always been in love. Today I'm in love. And when I fall in love all over my body. Every inch of me falls in love forever. I can't remember the names of some of the men I've fallen in love with forever. The faces change, it's the feelings that stay the same. This time it's going to be different. The guy I fell in love with, his name was CB, and that stood for Crazy Bastard, and that he was just very exciting. Was just talking about CB before I talked, and I remembered I just had such a good time with this guy. He was everything his name implies. And the only problem with the relationship with CB and I is that he didn't want to behave, and I'm always trying to kill him, and he don't like that. And I just wanted him to act right, you know, just We'd cruise around the orchards of Orange County in his motorcycle and make love under the orange groves, and, you know, just really a lot of fun. But many a times I had to come home when there was not enough chemicals to kill what I had, when I would turn on that light in the cold water shack and the sink would be black with cockroaches. I don't know how to do housework. I don't know how to do anything other than just go and do it. And my I was holding down a job just barely, thanks to Ben's dream. Yeah, now is the time when I spend my life as an unprotected, bar-drinking female. I know the feeling of degradation and self-loathing that a woman alcoholic goes through when she's unprotected and she's a bar-drinker, and to know that I am ugly and have to hide that. And I would come home, and in that shack live those two little girls that the romance of being a mother had long since died, and the responsibility just weighed heavy, and I hated their responsibility. They were in my way from going out for the thrills and excitement. And they were children. I didn't come here by myself. They were children with the big eyes. They were children that got to experience things that children should never experience. The battering, the abandonment. They were terrified of making any noise, because if they would make any noise and I would come to, I would start screaming and yelling, and then I would start hitting. And once I started hitting, it was like I couldn't stop and I wouldn't stop. There was so much frustration and anger inside of me, and I took it out at whoever was there, and they were always there. I had my youngest one time, just probably many times, but one time that I remember kneeling in front of me, begging me, please, mommy, don't beat me anymore. And you know, it was about a year ago that I heard that same voice call me from the Santa Ana jail and say, mommy, please come and get me. And I could not go. I could not go. I would not go because I know that I cannot rescue her from the madness she's in, that it has to be God. I can just say that I love you and be there for her. But that's further on. After 5 years of this type of living as an animal wouldn't live that way. I started getting letters from my dope fiend husband that was someplace in Texas getting the cure, and he says, he writes letters home, and he's got the muscles and the tattoos, and he says, babes, this time is going to be different. And so we got back together, and what happened there is he came home and found out I was drinking, and he knifed me, and then he told me he was sorry, so we went and got married. And anybody's going to knife you, you know, loves you. Well, otherwise, they wouldn't do that. We moved over to Mira Loma by Norco, and the best thing I can say about this place, it's close enough to Cucamonga to have wineries there. I didn't know it was low class to have to drink wine. I just like wine and tequila, you know, tequila because you're a Mexican, and wine by choice. I guess nowadays it's fashionable. At that time, it wasn't fashionable to be a wino, so you got to sneak around and pretend you drink good wine when you just really like Muscatel. White port and lemon juice. God, that's really a good mixed drink. That was my favorite. So anyway, we just went again, tried to make chicken salad out of chicken shit, and I married him in the Catholic Church. And we joined the PTA, and we bought a little ranch with the turkeys and the horses, and we were going to be farmers, his dope fiend and I, and we just were going to be like everybody else. But somehow or another, he got together with a neighbor's wife, and so I went and beat up the neighbor's wife, and I found out that if you're like everybody else, you don't do those things. But I did it, and I'm a firm believer you can place me in the best of circumstances, and sooner or later, I have to create what is inside of me, because it's inside of me I can't live. And so when he starts making the run to the Orange County to his connection, I start making the run to the wineries. And as I said, this weekend I had another change in my drinking. Where before I had been a party girl and a bar drinker and a hoop-de-doo person, now I just wanted to drink in my bedroom. I didn't want to go out. I just wanted to drink by myself. I couldn't stand being around people. I couldn't stand pretending or acting as if anymore. I just wanted to die. I got to the place in my drinking where I drank and I drank and I drank and my body was drunk and my mind was in agony and I couldn't stand the madness inside of me. I started looking for answers in life. I never thought that I was an alcoholic. Never entered my mind. You see, once I started taking pills, I thought that I started taking pills and booze and trying to, I think looking back today was control my drinking so I wouldn't have blackouts. Just to get to that place where it was just wonderful all the time. And if you're starting to take other chemicals to control your drinking, you know what that means. That means you've got to keep very busy and change the formula because things quit working real fast. And I had several doctors go in all the time and my husband's connection and what I could steal from people's medicine cabinet and just all kinds of fun things. Just tired and so busy, such a busy life. But little by little, everything quit working and I started reading the Bible and I started going to church and I've been sprinkled and dunked and prayed over. You know, you go to these churches and they say, who wants to be saved? I'd be the first one down there kneeling there to be saved. And when I went home and it was a lie one more time, the madness would come in and little by little, every hope and dream went out of my life and all I wanted to do was to die, just to die. I saved my sleeping pills and waited until this man was home one weekend because I couldn't stand to kill me in front of them two little girls for them to find me. And he was watching television and I said, I'm going to kill myself. He said, all right. Went back to watching television. No big deal. I came to a couple of days later enraged to be alive because I wasn't doing it for attention. I was doing it because I was weary and so tired, just absolutely tired. And that came to what has got to be the loneliest day of my life. And I had been in a coma both nights and every once did he was laying there with me in that bed and every once did he consider taking me to a doctor or to a hospital. I felt like so totally unwanted to. Long since I had run out of family and I had not friend one. He was all I had and yet he wanted me dead. You know, looking back upon that day, I realized that my higher power has always had his hand upon my life. Because that very day with a knock on the door is a lady from the PTA. If there's somebody I didn't want to see, it's a lady from the PTA. Yeah, she's from them dairy people. I'm a Barrio Mexican that moved over to Oakeytown. And she's from them people with them big houses. And they get dressed up to stay at home. And somebody else cleans their house. And my house got clean once when I moved there. And accidents happen when you're sleeping 2 days and two nights. Accidents happen in bed and you don't have time to clean up before there's a knock on the door in a moment of weakness. I'm really awful foggy from all those pills and I'm sure that otherwise I wouldn't have gone to the door. But there she was with her big grin on her face and looking like Susie Homemaker. And I let her in, and she looks at the state I'm in, and of course, you know, you can't help but see where I'm at. And I tell her my tale of woe, and I got a tale of woe about this SOB and how he done me wrong. And she stayed with me, and she cleaned me up, and she listened to me. And somewhere in the conversation, she asked me if I ever heard of Al-Anon. I'd never heard of Al-Anon, but I got the idea that if I went there, he would straighten up. So she cleaned me up and took me to Al-Anon. In defense of Al-Anon, I'd like to tell you that lady had only been there 3 months, had found some answers and wanted some answers for me because she could see the pain I was in. But I didn't fit in Al-Anon. I felt a little bit like a whorewood in a nunnery. There was absolutely no identification between me and them square broads. But I don't know. I never fit in anywhere. A bunch of women always made me uncomfortable anyway, especially them Anglo women. I don't know how they are. I just grin a lot. Someplace I had heard that I had a beautiful smile, so I had to get the heat off, just grin a lot. And I saw her about 11 years later, and they said they used to laugh at me. I'm glad I didn't know that, because I would have been crushed. I thought I was smiling. What I did is I had that brain dead out to lunch, grin a lot. And I don't hear anything, obviously. I just know they put their arm around me, them ladies, and every so often she comes, picks me up, and takes me there. It's such a sketchy time that I just know that I don't want to go anymore, but she takes me anyway. Now, during this time, I knew I couldn't divorce him. I'd married him in the Catholic Church. Everybody knows Catholics don't get a divorce because there just might be a hell you get to go there. But I used to contemplate justifiable homicide. Because if anybody deserved to die, he did. It would have been a mercy killing. You know, you get a hardcore heroin addict, the best thing to do with him is kill him. I mean, that's merciful. So when I heard the word release, I felt a relief inside of me. I went home and told him in detail how I was going to release him. I was going to make sure that he died slowly. I told him I was going to pour hot wax in his ears. I had read that someplace, like you throw acid in their eyes so they can't see, and then pour. It sounded good, doesn't it? I love that. So he'd sleep with his clothes on and a knife under the pillow, and I'd sit in a corner with a big black coat on and watch him. When he'd be a doze enough, I'd go take a little peek, and he'd go, it's so fulfilling. He always thought he was such a bad dude, got him some time, and a pachuco type. He was scared of me. I mean, that's really saying something. We had a marriage that wouldn't quit. We had either honeymoon or battle. I used to like to go for his face first, get all the scratches on him, and let him explain that to his partners. And now the next day when he would say some unkind things to me, he'd say, "Baby, I may have a monkey on my bed, but you got an orangutan." I thought he was so bad, he made me look good. One day I came home and he was gone. He took everything with him. He wasn't planning on coming back. And that's the way it had to be, because that life was unbearable. It was familiar. And I'd have stayed there till I'd have killed him or forced him to kill me, because I didn't know you could move. My fear of being alone was so intense that I could not move. I couldn't do anything else but just stay there petrified. And see, when he left, that Al-Anon lady took me to my first AA meeting. And I was really ashamed, because I thought the Al-Anon people had gotten together and decided that they didn't want me there. So they were going to send me to their husbands, who they didn't like either. Just because I interpreted they didn't like their husbands, because I was there because I didn't like mine either. And I was just trying to get him to change. And so then I'd be all right. And so I walked into the young people's meeting in Pomona in 1964, and I sat in the back and listened to the sounds of Alcoholics Anonymous. The very first thing that attracted me to you was what was happening between you, because I had never heard it. I listened to that belly laughter, that smile that reaches your soul, and that happy talk, and those are the sounds of Alcoholics Anonymous. The very first thing that attracted me to you was the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what they're talking about. I don't know what type of a meeting it was. I know how I felt when I was with you, you see. And I looked around and I hungered for it. And I wanted whatever you had. I just thought, it's too bad I'm not an alcoholic. If there's another name for the disease that you and I have, it's called I Ain't Got It. I knew I was weird and I knew I was different and three steps ahead of the men with the butterfly nets. I just knew that I wasn't an alcoholic. I used to be an alcoholic, but I'm not one anymore. I just got a lot of troubles. A newcomer, if you'd be lucky like me. I just sat back there and let it wash over my soul. I've often wondered, what is it and where does it come from? And it came to me one day, and I consider it a spiritual experience, when I realized that these are just empty rooms. That which happens in here, we bring it with us, every one of us, and it intermingles and becomes a group conscience, a higher power. You call it whatever you want, but there is a dynamic something that happens when you and I come together, and I wanted it. And it programmed out the only thing that I ever understood, the only thing that ever caught my attention. My motives have never been pure. I looked around at all them sober, single, good-looking young guys, and I said, man, I'm going to get me one of those. And I did. It was the sickest one there. It had to be. I got radar. But I'm one that believes that it takes what it takes, and that's what it took for me. I came around as a visitor for 10 months. In Pomona in those days, everybody went around the room and gave their name. When it came to me, I'd say, I'm Angie and I'm a visitor. I would not say I'm an Al-Anon, not after they kicked me out of there. I just said I'm a visitor, and nobody said you don't belong here. Somehow you looked in my eyes and knew that I couldn't stand any more rejection. You just put your arm around me, and you said, keep coming back. The most important words that you've ever said to the likes of me, keep coming back. Do you know what that feels like when you're used to people saying, keep on going, weirdo? Huh? What a disappointment it was to me when I found out you were telling that to everybody. I thought it was just me. It made me feel so good, so warm inside. I'd have done anything that you told me to do just because I was so hungry for love. After a while, I stopped taking the pill, I stopped drinking because I started feeling a little strange still drinking. I might be a little alcoholic, nothing too desperate, but I'll stop drinking. It ain't no big deal. Anybody can stop drinking, especially if you doubled up on the Miltowns and Benzedrine. You don't really need much. You do get a little weirder, and this guy gets tired. Somehow the men, when they're sober, they don't want to be killed. And I always somehow always thought through violence you make people behave. And so he tries to get rid of me, and I'm not easy to get rid of because I didn't have a backup. So I moved to Pomona to be closer to the action, and I walk into a room one day, and there's this cute little boy talking. He had big blue eyes and blonde hair. And I have an affinity for blue eyes and blonde hair. It is now blue eyes and gray hair because time marches on. But he's sitting there talking, and he just got out of the boys' reformatory. He was 21, and I was 32 going to 92. And this cute little thing is saying he don't have a girlfriend, he don't have a surfboard, he don't have a car. I have a maternal instinct, and I said, come here, little boy, I'll take care of you. And I did. And I educated him on sick bras. I mean, that guy didn't know what hit him. But good things come out of everything, right? Even if they're bad. After that relationship was over, he decided to become a minister, and I'd like to think that somehow in my small way, I helped push him over to God. I don't like women, and I don't trust men, and they don't leave you much. And you had told me that if I quit everything, I'd feel wonderful. Just keep coming back and live happily ever after. That's all I ever wanted. I never heard about withdrawals. You never told me that. All I know is that that was a bright and a wonder. I never had liked it. I didn't have any skin on. I could not predict in half an hour how I was going to feel. I may be feeling wonderful right now. Half an hour, I'm trying to kill myself for you. I never could sleep. God, if I could only sleep, I'd walk them streets without any skin on. And he was the first man that had ever been kind to me. He was the first man that had ever been gentle with me. And everywhere that he went, he wanted to take me with him. He was always seemed so proud to be seen with me. Me that had always been abused and misused by every man I'd ever had, and I'd have stayed there forever if I could have. Bill Wilson said in his writings that the good is the enemy of the best, and I was always willing to settle for some little corner of good because I never thought there would be anything more, you see. He was the one that would hold me close when the madness would be so awful. I couldn't stand it when all I could do was kick and scream and yell and go berserk. I used to call it going berserk. And I even had a cat run away from home once when I threw a can through the sliding glass door, and the cat ran away and never came back. I'm so old and too little girl would have liked to do that, you see, because I was not alone. I didn't come here by myself.
I brought two little girls with me, with all that madness inside of me and all that terror in their little hearts, you see. And I know that I had all the hopes in me crushed out of me because I
died before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I really did die and I didn't know it. And I wasn't dead yet, you see, when I still wanted something that I couldn't have, and that was to just be okay inside of me at that time. I know that you and I do not come together by accident. I truly believe that we come together by divine appointment. By new divine appointment, we touch each other's life. And yet every relationship has begun and it's parting. And when you go on your way, you take a little bit of me with you, and you leave a little bit of you behind, and we're never the same because our lives have touched. I am really grateful today, looking back, that God sent that gentle young man into my life at the time when I needed some gentleness. And we walked this road for a long time. 6.5 years. In between there, I was sober about 6 months when he drank again, and I didn't have nothing going for me, and so I drank too. And it was not my worst drunk. It just seems to be the most painful one. It seemed to me that the madness came back, and I didn't even know it had been gone. And I knew I had tried Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew it worked. It worked for you. But good things always work for you. It was like hearing somebody winning $150,000 in Reno. You know what happens to them, but nothing ever happens to me. I'm here tonight because a man named Carson, a man that people would talk about and say that he used to prey on young women in the program. I don't know about that. Sometimes you and I know I have been guilty of it too, do some character assassination and don't know what we're talking about. I know that Carson saved my life and he never got out of line with me. I know he just called me up one day and says, "Angie, come to a meeting with me." And I says, "I can't go. I've been drinking." And he says, "Come anyway." I had, again, the night before, tried to kill myself through hanging myself, and my children had thrown their arms around my knees and said, "Mommy, Mommy, please don't kill yourself." Can you imagine the terror of two little girls going through that? I can't today, and that's why I am so grateful that I can give them love because of you've shown me how. And I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous on a rainy Wednesday night in December. And the miracle for me is not that I've come to Alcoholics Anonymous, because hundreds and hundreds of people come and don't stay. The miracle for me is that I'm still here. I was and am one of the desperate ones that had no place else to go. The miracle for me is that last December the 22nd, I celebrated my 22nd birthday. That is the miracle for me. And I salute you because a victory is not mine. It belongs to us. I am composed today of a little bit of a lot of people. I didn't know how to live. I showed you my life before I came here. It is a completely different story than what I have today. But it is because of people like you that I have allowed to get close, that you've allowed me to get close. And you have a hunger to share with me, and I have a hunger to share with you. And that's what we do in places like this. We come together because there's a push on the inside to share that miracle with one another. I came back to you terrified, for before I had been a little alcoholic, now I thought I was too alcoholic, and I have a little trouble with an in-between state there on anything. At first, they start reading stuff all wrong for people like me. They start reading something that says, "Rarely have we seen a person fail." I don't know about the rest of you, when they say "rarely," I know somebody's not going to make it. And then they say, "They are such unfortunates, they are not at fault, they seem to have been born that way." I thought, man, I'm screwed. My mother will tell you I was born that way, and who would know more than one's mother? But a little further on down it says, "And then there are those that have grave emotional and mental disorders." I am so grateful they have that in there. That's the catch-all for those of us that think our case is different. A little further on down, it says many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Now, I'm not presumptuous to stand up here and tell you I have the capacity to be honest, because I don't know the difference between right and wrong. You may not believe that that's so, but I'll tell you, you can't live in a cold, dark room without any structure, without any guidance, without anything and anybody to ever depend on, and all of a sudden come to Alcoholics Anonymous and know the difference between right and wrong to belong here. It took me a long time, a lot of one day at a time. It really helps not to have any place else to go. It really helps not to have any choices, to be desperate, to clutch at straws. I know that underneath all my character defects, and I have given up trying to have my character defects removed. My sponsor assures me that if God removes all my character defects, I'll disappear. So I just, the best thing to do is just get comfortable with them. And let those be removed that need to be removed, and the rest of them, everybody else feels comfortable because they know you got them. And the newcomers think I'm wonderful because they know the only thing that ruins it for the newcomer around me is that I kill all the hope that they're going to get happily ever after. You know, I kill all the hope for them, and they say things like, well, how come she's not any well by 22 years? Well, I'm here to tell you I didn't come here to get well. I came here because them hard shares, I paid a price for them, and I'm not in any danger of getting well. I just try a lot of things that don't work to find out the ones that do. And I've done everything wrong that there is to do wrong. The only thing that I have not done is picked up that drink, and the reason for that is because my higher power has touched me. That's the only reason. Just like you. And my job is to carry whatever message that has been shared and given with me to me. You know, I can go home and pray about it. If I want something bad enough, I can go home and pray about it and meditate about it, and sooner or later, God, and after 3 days of praying and meditating and not fasting, you sooner or later you're going to come to the conclusion that it's God's will for me. Once I lay me that story, it ain't nothing to lay it on you. But God sends people into our life that ruin that people call sponsors. I have a sponsor that's it's Mary R. Reagan from Tustin that ruins stuff for me. She says things to me like, Angie, you don't have to sit in your own shit just because it's warm. And you get no sympathy around here. I called my daughter not too long ago. She is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. My oldest daughter had 7 years last May, and it's just... We're great friends, but you know, you can't lay no more guilt trips on them. I said, I don't know what problems I had with her, and she says, Mom, get off the cross, we need the lumber. So then you call your sponsor. You got to find somebody. Call your sponsor, and she says, who's not doing it your way? You know, that really made me mad, hurt my feelings. Until I stopped to think of it, the only time I'm really unhappy is when they're not doing it my way. I'm just so, isn't this program wonderful, and isn't life wonderful when God and I are deciding that His will is good for me? When I'm deciding that He's good, when things are going my way, it's really what it amounts to. It's just wonderful. But let things not go my way, see how I whine and complain. Anyway, I married that young man. I didn't have no sponsor because I don't like them women any more sober than I did when I was drinking, because they look at you. Those that got a lot of time look at you. You know, I don't want them to look at me. I don't want them to see whatever they're saying. Today I know they know that they knew what they were saying, because I do too. And I don't like them young girls because I got to save my young husband from them young girls. They just go this way, honey. The men are always so much kinder, so when I have I started getting resentments. In the beginning, they were all so wonderful. Then after a while, I couldn't stand one. Have you ever hated a member of Alcoholics Anonymous? Probably not. I know there's nobody here that crass, but I did. Oh, I mean, I hated everything about this guy, the way he walked, the way he talked, the way he smoked, everything about him. There's an exquisite type of a resentment feeling in you. Just goes when it's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You walk into the room, and I wasn't happy till I saw, oh, God, there he is. And I'd go to some of the people, I put my grin on my face. I went to them guys because I heard resentments. I was the number one offender for the alcoholic. They're fatal. God, that would bring me too. I would do most anything not to drink. So I went to some of them guys that looked like they knew what they're talking about. And I asked, how do you get over resentments? And they said, turn it over easy. Does it this too shall pass one day at a time. Go home, read the books, come back and don't drink. That's how we tell each other, isn't it? I went home and did it and come back the next night and I tested it and I, oh, God, there it is again. So I'd go to somebody else and again they'd say, turn it over, easy does it, this too shall pass. One day at a time, go home, read the book, come back and don't drink. After a while, I got the message, you don't know the answer either. But I better do this stuff or you won't let me come, keep coming back. So I went and did it. And you know what? I stayed here long enough to let the miracle happen to me. It helps to be desperate. It helps not to have any place else to go. Because I stayed here long enough to find out the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. To have all that madness go away when you know that you belong. And that happened to me. I was sober 9 months. And it was the longest time that I'd ever been sober. And it was happening to me. When I found that out is when this man was crying at a meeting. I don't know what kind of a tragedy he'd had, and I was so embarrassed for him. I said, God, he's crying. How embarrassing. Hasn't he ever heard of John Wayne or Imo Jima or Emiliano Zapata or Pancho Villa? God, he's crying. God. I thought crying was for women. You know, men were supposed to be tough and have it all together, and here he's a sissy. Oh, God. After the meeting, everybody went and put their arm around him, and I didn't want you to know that I was the only dog among you, so I went and put my arm around him, too. I gave him one of them stiff arm hugs, you know, the ones that you keep coming back type of hugs. And when he started crying and put his head on my shoulder, all that anger and resentment melted away as if it had never been. And I knew then the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't stand him 5 minutes before. I couldn't stand the sight of him. And now there was a tenderness because I understood pain. I understood pain when it was that close. And I learned that there are times that I have to be patient and tolerant for you. And there's times that you need to be patient and tolerant for me. You would say things to me before that, like, I wouldn't resent anybody bad enough to want him to get drunk. And I thought, oh, my God, they're going to find out that I wish that guy would get drunk so he could get out of here. I just want people to drink or die or something when I, you know, just take them away so I could be all right. Just do this for me so I could be all right. But you see, it isn't that way with me. It has to come from the inside out as a gift. My higher power, the ability to see when I couldn't see before, you see. And that's what has happened to me. Today, on a clear day, I can see forever. And I know that the longer I am sober, the wider the horizon and the narrower the road. And it doesn't happen by Saturday, and it doesn't happen by Thursday. It just happens one day at a time. Tomorrow is not promised to anybody. Today is enough for today. When I was new, I only had a thimbleful, and I used to say I never had it so good, and the thimbleful was enough because I was full. You see, the longer I am sober, my ability to accept the good, it grows. Many things have happened to me in sobriety, not all of them good, but all of them necessary, just like the things in my drinking. I married that young man, and my children started drinking and using drugs, and the day came when my higher power knew that I was still in bondage, and I didn't know it, but he knew it. What happened is that I used to pray, God, spare my babies, and he didn't spare my babies, and I went into a depression. My children ran off. We had a terrible, terrible fight with blood and blows and just an ugly scene in my home. We always had scenes like that in our home. And I didn't want you to know, and I still had secrets. And I felt ashamed that I was not well like you seem to be. I had a nervous breakdown. That young man went and took me to the psycho ward, went home, packed his clothes, and left me. I felt abandoned by everybody. I felt devastated. You had lied to me. You had told me I would get better, and I wasn't better. And the only reason I didn't drink at that time is because it never occurred to me. And I didn't know it was not occurring to me. I just wanted to die. I was tired. I just did not want to die. I was the best me I'd ever been, and it wasn't it either. And I stand before you, before us, you came around me one more time and became my higher power one more time when I had nothing going for me. It is from the women that came around me that I learned to be a woman. I felt so devastated I had no more walls. I was able to share the secrets of my heart with you, and you shared the secrets of your heart with me, and I realized I was not so different. Maybe we drank in different places, but you felt just as dirty as I had felt dirty in the bars. You had had the self-rejection as I had had, and the helplessness and the hopelessness. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we learned to be each other's mamas. I never had a mama, not really. And here I have been mothered, and you listened to me, and you hugged me, and you listened to me cry, and you took me home with me, and you held me, and I knew that you cared about me, and I learned to care about you. You loved me long before I learned to love you back. I've heard things like, you have to love yourself before you can love anybody. That you got to have self-esteem before you can do anything. It has not been that way for me. I just know that I love how I am when I am with you. And that I copy what you do in this program. And the miracles happen in my life. And the changes come about. And I've learned to love you. And I've let you love me long before I learned to love me. But it has happened. It does happen. I am the proof that it can happen. And not because I say it, or not because I'm special or different than anybody here. I'm not the one that has the best program in this room, or neither any of these speakers. I know that I'm arrogant enough to speak for all of us, but I do know that there is a gift that we all have, and it's for one particular thing. And the easiest gift to have is the gift of communication, the gift to talk it. And you know, when I talk it, I got to live it. And I didn't know it then, because I still had secrets. I made peace with my God at that time. I was so mad at God because he had everything happen to good to everybody but me. And I said, okay, God, I'm never going to be happy again. All you ever want me to do is work with the sick women, drunks, let them puke on me. All right, all right. And I don't know about your higher power. My mind has a weird sense of humor. When I want something so bad, oh, God, just this time, just this one time, God, it don't happen. As soon as you say, oh, screw him, here it comes. I don't know why it happens that way. When I got to the other side, when I got beyond the part where you want to put a shotgun about 2 inches from his belly and watch all the gore go all over, or you get run him down in the freeway and back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. My sponsor tells me they don't lock you up for being crazy, only for acting crazy. When I got on the other side, I touched the power and I touched the strength that was way down inside of me. After all this said and done, it's only you and me, God, anyway. That which I demanded of them, they never had it to give, you see. That belongs to my higher power. And there is a freedom and there is a strength when you touch that, and it can be for every one of you. And I knew that I was never going to be happy again, and I started working with the women, and I found another secret. I was so hungry to be loved. And when you love me, it feels good. But when I care about you, it feels exactly the way I thought you loving me would feel. And that's another secret. When the dependency of other people gets to be less, the dependency of my higher power gets to be more. And the freedom to go and be wherever, because it's going to be all right no matter what. No matter what. I kept falling in love, and you know, I thought, one day at a time I don't drink because I'm an alcoholic. And one day at a time I don't steal because I'm a thief. And one day at a time I don't get married because I don't know what happens to them. I kiss a perfectly good prince that turns into a toad. I don't know what happens to them. And I have experienced death in sobriety. The death of my sister, that she killed herself. And I could not believe what was before my eyes, because I was the one that found her. And I realized how fragile life is. And I learned to love my loved ones that are before me, whether it's family or you that are before me, because this is now. This is now. This is all we have. It may not be no tomorrow. And so I've learned to live one day at a time. Those things come out of left field. I think God laughs when we say, oh, goodness, what this? And here it's coming from left field, way over there. And we're all looking for it, digging up. It's like my dog when he's looking for a gopher and he's digging into this hole. The gopher's long gone, way over there. And I said, oh, please, God, just this one time, God. 2 weeks after my sister killed herself, I became a grandma. God, and I don't know about, I never knew how to be a mother, but I'm a good grandma. I mean, them kids think grandma and Santa Claus are the same thing. They can't see Santa Claus, but they see grandma. And, you know, grandma hasn't gotten over all the people-pleasing part. You know, they want something, I go get it. I don't know how to say no to them. Recently, they wanted, grandma, daddy said that he couldn't afford a Nintendo, that you'd get it for me. I said, $100 for a game, can you believe that? I had to get out my trusty credit card and go out and get a Nintendo. I fell in love again. I don't even want to fall in love again. But I fell in love with a newcomer. If any friends, any spiritual giants here, I'll tell you that it offended me too. And your friends don't have no class either. You go around with this guy whose eyes are still spinning, and they ask you, is he one of us? Yeah. Yes, you know what's coming next, don't you? How long has he been sober? 5 minutes or... My friend Frank Sloan from Simi Valley says, Jesus Christ, Angie, give that poor guy a break! My sponsor told me he was a nice guy and it's okay, and to tell him that I scooped him in before anybody else would. So that's what I tell him. I said, I scooped him in before anybody else did. Shuts him up, don't it? What else can they tell you? The only time you got to maintain an image is when you say you want him to think you're well or perfect. If they think you're crazy, and they let you get away with so much stuff. And so I moved to Blythe, and I've lived happily ever after. Sort of. They weren't ready for me in Blythe in the AA meeting, and I got rid of all the weeds, and now all we have is people that work the steps and stick to the traditions. Not because they want to, because they're scared of me. I took my oldest little girl, grandchild, to a conference once, and I had a long white blouse that covers a multitude of tortillas and beans, and a long, long white pants on, and she looked up at me and said, Grandma, you look just like the white angel. And I looked at this child, and there was a magic, an electricity that went between us. And you see, I saw me through her eyes. All she's ever seen is what you've done with me. She's never had to have the beatings and the batterings that her mother had. She never has had to see her grandmother so battered and crawling around in her own filth. She's never had to see the ugliness of our disease, you see. She's just seen the beauty. But her mother has seen the ugliness. I have another daughter. I have another daughter that's out there somewhere. I don't know where she is today, but she's still putting a needle in her arm, and she still says, Mom, it's too hard for me. And every so often she calls up just to get some love from her mother. She knows it doesn't work for money anymore, but she just calls up to rest for a little while, to rest assured that there is an answer for her whenever she's ready. I know the last chapter isn't written. I know her life is none of my business. I know that my life is none of my business. What I must be doing is go about my Father's business, go about doing whatever has been given to me, to share it with you, to give you the hope, if you identify with me, that you can sit and stand up here one day and say, I never had it so good. To be able to get up here, and this is the price that I pay for the hugs that I get, the love that I get. When I walk 10 feet off the ground, fills up all the empty places. As has been said to here, there is no route that leads from there to here. You can't live in a cold, dark room without any darkness, without any light, without any walls. You can't live in a bedroom and cry out in agony, because you can't live and you can't die and you can't drink and you can't be sober, because there really is no road that leads from there to here except that you and I be touched by a power greater than ourselves. Thank you so much for having me.